Good afternoon. A number of people are still in the lunchroom, I think, so they'll get in a little bit, but let's get started here. Welcome to something we have never done in ASA before, so it's something brand new. We've never had a 75th anniversary before, so everything we do is kind of new, I guess. I meant to ask last night at the dinner as to who had attended the 50th anniversary. Is there anybody here who attended the 50th anniversary meeting 25 years ago?
It was
a Wheaton College.
Wheaton?
Yeah, okay. We've got a few.
Probably.
Right, okay. So we've got a good share of attendees over here. So what we've been thinking about this for a while, and it really is special that ASA is an organization where members have some longevity and stick-to-itiveness that says a lot about the organization. And I think we've got a nice blend of retention as well as the turnover, new people coming in, so it's a good blend. But as we think about these 75 years, we just really wanted to take the time for some of the longest-serving members here and kind of get some perspectives that wouldn't normally come up in any of the talks. So what we're going to do in three separate sessions, three half-hour sessions, in each of these sessions or talks, we'll have three longtime members here, and we're going to ask them to address two questions and something that all of you, but none of us, can see. I'll show you these later. First round, I'll ask each of them to take 3 minutes to address something about themselves, you know, kind of who they are, how they come across ASA, what did ASA do for them. Secondly, we're going to give each of them 3 minutes to talk about ASA focus, in terms of, hey, what was ASA like back then, how did it change, and what advice do we have in the future, where should we go? Because I believe that the focus here today should not be on the past as much as the future, because the next 75 years are critically important, you know. And I don't know about you, but I was kind of interested to see last night from Ted's talk about the way in which the culture war is fairly constant. I'm saying, you know, what has ASA done to resolve the culture wars? You know, are we making progress? There's still a lot of work to be done, so I think we do need to look forward. So that's the way it's going to be for each of these sessions. And so we'll take in order, look at the dates at which they joined ASA is over there, and I'll let each of them introduce themselves a little bit more. John, why don't you get us started?
All right, thanks. I'm new to this business of being an old guy. And so in the movie Men in Black, I identify more with Will Smith's character. He's the guy who turns to the old, he says, hey, you old guys, pay attention. And I feel like a young guy still. 1974, though, is actually quite a ways away. And I came into ASA as an undergraduate. I was on the stretch program. I was actually in my undergraduate program from 65 to 69. And then the Vietnam War and a lot of cultural conflict and issues got in the way. I diverted from that, and I came back to it in 73, 74, and joined the ASA at that point. I was given a student membership, as I recall. I think that might have been sort of the early iteration of that kind of activity. But and I remember Dr. Jim Kennedy was our chair of our department.
Hold the mic close.
Hold a little closer. And Jim was really encouraging. And Dr. Ralph Lowell, who had his PhD in biology and in theology, a degree in theology as well. They were a huge influence on me to get started in the ASA. I don't know if you want any current biographical stuff or you...
No, whatever you want. 3 minutes.
So I had been in Christian higher education my entire career. So I'm zeroing in here on 33 years at this. I said one more year and out. 70 is old enough, and it's hard to imagine that I'm approaching that age. So I look back on a at what ASA has done, and I think of it in, Randy, what you're talking about, in biblical terms. Mm-hmm. The Bible really talks about intergenerational. It's our fathers and our fathers' fathers, our children and our children's children. And that's the project we're engaged in. That's what Christian higher education is. That's what ASA is about. I think that's what we're trying to do. And I think this kind of an event is a testimony to that.
Okay, very good. Thank you. Harold.
I'm Harold Stevens. And when I was in high school, I went to the same church as the Everests and the Moons. So I got to know them even before I went to college. And in fact, one of the Moon boys was one of my best friends. We went to high school together. So then went away to Westmont and got my degree in chemistry and came back, and Alton Everest recruited me to join ASA. So that was my introduction to the organization and how I got into it. It says, how did it impact me? If I remember correctly, one of the things that Richard Bube said was that the Bible answers the questions of who and why, and science answers the questions of when and how. Well, fortunately, the ASA has really solidified and encouraged my convictions on the who and why answers. But it has totally devastated my dogmatic assumptions on the how and when. Those questions are still totally unanswered as far as I'm concerned. But I think that's one good thing that I've taken away from this, belonging to this group, is learning all of the different viewpoints that can be consistent with Scripture. And we can have different ideas on how it happened, but still come back to the basic foundation that it was God that did it in the first place, however he chose to do it. And we can fellowship together in that knowledge and confidence. So I might remark too that one of my memories of those early years was seeing one of the guys from Moody Institute, which was just a few blocks from our church, get up on that coil that you saw in the slides last night and have the sparks shoot from their hands. That was pretty impressive for a high school kid. And another thing they did sometimes was hold a board in their hands and try and light it on fire. So that was quite an interesting part of my high school education.
Okay. Thank you very much, Martin.
Okay. I'm Martin Price. I was raised as a nominal Christian. Little rural Presbyterian church in Appalachian, part of Ohio. When I was a sophomore in college at an intervarsity conference, I made a decision that I was going to try to live for Christ. Well, before I was really a Christian, not much at stake. I had no concerns about apparent conflicts between science and faith. But once I had made that commitment, suddenly it makes a world of difference whether it was really, these things were really true. And I really agonized over those. And over the course of finishing my doctorate, I came across a few books that were helpful to me. When I was a young beginning college professor at Geneva College in the chemistry department, one day I went to the department chairman and said I'd joined this other organization that had things to say about creation, but it doesn't quite seem right to me. Do you have any ideas? And he said, well, there's this organization called American Scientific Affiliation. And it's a group of scientists across the country who are Christians. And I think at the very least, we ought to support them by being members of them.
So what's the name? Who
Roy was Adams. He was Roy department Adams. Chairman. And so I did, not really knowing much of why, except, well, that sounds like a good group and it'd be a good idea to join it. I never really picked up on the most important part of it, was going to be the most important part of it for me, until there was the ASA annual conference was held in Geneva College. Mm-hmm. And so I went to all those meetings. Well, then it ceased to just become an organization. The talks were fascinating, but also I was meeting interesting Christians and who were had thought through many of these things. And that was it began helping me see that I'm actually joining a community, a whole North American community. And looking back on it now, I know I couldn't count the numbers, but all kinds of men and women who are scientists across the United States and into Canada.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we're hearing some themes that I suspect we'll hear throughout this afternoon, but this whole theme of, as a young person getting a recommendation from an either a faculty member or older person, you join because of that kind of reference. And it's a very good lesson for all of us to be on the lookout for the young people who don't know about it, may not know why to join, but can follow those recommendations. Okay, let's, was that it? I didn't want to cut you off here. Your time is up anyway.
Yes, that was it.
Yeah, right. We'll come back. We'll get some more time here. Let's go on to, or did you want to add something? Yeah, okay. Let's go on to the second part. The first part was more egocentric here. Let's get a little ASA-centric. Tell us about your perspective. You've been around a long time. What do you see in ASA? What's changed and where should it go?
That's an interesting question, and I want to see if I can just take us back and think to a member who I wish was with us today, Bud Bauma, Hessel Bauma III, from professor at Calvin, passed away, I think it's two years ago now, mm-hmm. Quite suddenly. And Bud and I were really good friends through ASA. And in our conversations, Bud said something, because we came in at about the same time into the organization, and we represented that post-war baby boom generation, that wave of tsunami of students that arrived at university in 1965, 66, 67, and just sort of kept coming. And Bud said something interesting. There aren't many of us in our age class. Now, we think like ecologists, right? So we talk about population dynamics. There are not many of us in our age class. And that was quite striking as I looked around. And my sense of the organization, especially when I started and for early on, was that it was white, it was male, and it was white on the hair as well. White on the head. And so the demographics, the makeup of our organization, in some ways reflected the church, and all of that kind of societal expectations. And that was the circumstance, and then I've seen it as an organization over the year, we've taken deliberate steps to make changes in that. And reaching out to students, reaching out to women, reaching out to people of other the racial demographic as well, we're getting more diverse. It is a huge challenge. But as an organization, I think we're moving in that direction, and that's great to see.
Thank you, John, and may I just echo that I'm pleased at progress. I think we all know we have a long way to go, and we can't relax and say, good, we made some progress. Yes, we have, but we've got a lot of work to do, and I'm glad that a lot of people are focused on that. So, Harold.
One difference that I see personally is that in my early years, I think there was more opportunities to attend local section meetings. Now, that could be just a quirk of geography of where I happen to be living, but that's one thing that I, for me personally, has become harder to take part in, because it just doesn't happen that often in my particular area. But as I see the general direction that the organization is going, I agree with him. It's I think we're doing as much as we possibly can to reach out to students and other cultures and whatever. Another thing I would like to see, but I have no idea how to do it, is to become more involved with or accepted by or known by churches, because that, I think, is one of the areas that is still a stronghold of, well, should I say it, the New Earth type of mindset that can be antagonistic to what people conceive of as the Christian's head in the sand look at origins. And I hope that we can find some way to be more of a voice in the churches, so that we can change that perception somewhat.
Okay, thank you very much. I'd like to just thank you and appreciate your first part of your comment, your emphasis on the local chapter. I mean, that's very much my experience too, because you can interface with the local chapter more easily when you don't have to travel to a national meeting that moves all around and not consistent. And I'm pleased to see that the leadership of ASA now is really focused on it. Like many of you are, I don't know if Mark is here, I can't see anybody in the audience, but CSCA got a grant to be able to hire for 3 years a person to focus on generating new local chapters. So in the next 3 years, they're going to start 9 local chapters in Canada. And I hope in the U.S. we can ride on those coattails and move on, because it's critical that we have a balance. The local chapters can't do what the national one does, but the national one can't do what the local sections do, and we need that balance. So thank you for bringing that up. I think it's a good point. Mark?
The meetings are very similar to my early recollections, with one exception. For the first several years that I attended, there was one keynote speaker who would speak at each of the sessions, 2 or 3 at least. And now in the last several years, I think it's a big improvement. We have 1, 2, or 2 or 3 at least speaking, so you get to hear more people. And I've really appreciated that. I am concerned at what appears to be declining membership of the members, and I've pondered what can be the cause of that. Part of it, I think, well, why does someone want to join the ASA? And nobody's going to join some might. I guess I did, in a sense. I joined because I felt I ought to, before I realized what the benefits were. But I think about why someone might join or why others are not. And at the very least, it might be that felt need that of something. But more likely, it's going to be when they can realize or participate in the sense of fellowship, the sense of community across the whole North America. And any way that we can communicate that is going to be a big help.
I think that resonates well with what we heard this morning, this notion of a community. And I'm glad to see you pick up on that and stress that, because this notion of fellowship or network, whatever the modern day words are, but seeing each other face to face, talking, getting together here, knowing that you're part of the community. And I know a lot of people are part of communities back home, and they feel a cognitive dissonance with some of the ideas about science. And here, we can't do everything, but in the arena of science and faith, we can be a community of openness.
So another felt need might be faculty need to make presentations. They look for opportunities, and this certainly is an important one. Yeah. In my case, we wanted to meet with individuals, professors who might have students that would want to become interns down at ECHO with us. So there are felt needs that can be met in a number of ways.
All right, that's great. So the session is designed in such a way that we've given them each about 3 minutes to address each of the questions, and now we wanted to open it up for a little bit more of a dialogue. We have an extra mic here, and we've got about 5 minutes here that we can ask a little bit more questions. Does anyone in the audience want to comment or ask a question? All right, let's take that over there so we can hear you. All right. Thank you.
Thank you so much for, not for those up there, and obviously those are going to come and speak on VIP. I wanted to particularly say that, I look around in this room and I don't see too many college folks. Forgive me if I don't see you, but the thing is, I think what's near and dear to my heart, Randy knows this, is that diversity also includes age, right, and seniority. And I would like to see an opportunity for the young folk to interact more and dialogue more with our senior members, because I think there's a lot of lessons to be learned. One thing I realized in Ted Davis's talk is that the social status and the issues of science and faith are not new, right? It's pretty much the same, and the context of it is very similar. And my question is, what are some ways that I feel like I'm in the middle age group, what are some things that we can do to promote that dialogue and to facilitate those kind of unique experiences? Because I think it can enrich the richness of ASA.
Okay, John, now that you're on the council, you've got all the answers, don't you? Yeah.
Of course. That was the platform I ran on.
Right.
I was elected, and I will fulfill my promises. But you're touching on something that I think really is. We're at a moment of strategic planning in the council. I discovered that when I came on. And I think institutionally we're at a critical moment. And to accomplish what you're talking about, I think you really need to be intentional. We need to set that as a goal. I'm in another organization working with universities, and its goal is that every student in the world in a university would have the opportunity at least once during their experience to hear from a Christian university professor. Wouldn't it be interesting if we had a goal of making sure that every young person graduating from high school and university in our churches across this great land had the opportunity to interact with a Christian who is a scientist and has natural and social science experience? And so if we set that as our goal, then we have to figure out what's the means to achieve that. But I think we first start by being intentional, right, about saying this is what we want to do. That's going to need to be shaped in some way.
Let me jump in and ask, when you joined, did you perceive, because back then you're a little younger than you are now, but did you perceive any intentional actions? Did ASA do anything specific that you felt bridged that age gap or other diversity gaps?
Let me just very quickly follow up, because Walt has come in now and is sitting there, and Walt embodies exactly what we're talking about. When I, in 1974, joined, 1977, I went to graduate school, PhD program at Berkeley, and I knew that Walt was in the organization and contacted him, and ended up on Shattuck Avenue, and Walt and Jenny got to be really good friends, and the local chapter, and I think Ken Olson is here in the audience, and a number of other people in the Bay Area. And as a graduate student, they just took me in and gave me that mentoring, and we had the opportunity for the dialogue and the conversation and the growing.
So you're suggesting that our strategic approach should be to clone Walt Turner. Cloning is almost to that point.
Right, and we've got the capacity to do so.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Okay. About one more minute here. Any follow-on comments or anything? Otherwise, we'll give our next panelists a chance. Any other quick follow-ups? Yeah, go ahead.
I did not feel any lack or anything. It met my expectations and exceeded them, and Walt was a big part of that too, because I remember at that first conference he came out and saw what I was doing with the InterVarsity books and so forth. He even wrote it up in the newsletter. The newsletter was a big help, by the way,
yes,
to feel the sense, because not very often I could afford to go to the conference.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. Where's Vicki? Let's write down, revitalize the newsletter. You know, we've got to make it a vehicle of community, I think. And there's a lot to do. No one can do what Walt did, but there are other things that can be done that can be helpful on that. Okay, thank you all. Let's give them a big round of applause. And let's see. All right, if Walt, Jack Merton, Ken Olson, no, you guys are all here. I just can't see you because of all the bright lights, but I'm sure you're here. And we still haven't heard enough from you. We have to keep pushing it. So come on up and take a chair. Walt, why don't you get your first chair?
Let's sit
according to age. Yeah, sit according to wisdom.
No, time will
probably. Yeah, okay. Well, this is not even alphabetical order. We'll get it on.
I'm number three here.
No, you should be there. Let's go on for a little bit. Let's pass that around. Walt, you get the honors here a little bit. Let's see. Can we start? No, we've got 45 seconds here. But I think most of you were here. Some of you have come in since we started. So let me just briefly take those 30 seconds and just comment about what we're doing here. We're going to give each of these three gentlemen a chance to answer two sets of questions. The first one is a little self-serving. Tell us about yourself and what impacted you about ASA. And secondly, we're going to be ASA-centric, saying, what's your advice and perspectives on ASA? So, it's simple. All right, what were you doing when you joined ASA? How'd you hear about it? Why did you join? What impact has it had? Any or all or whatever? Walt?
I discovered ASA when I was a grad student at Illinois. I also discovered InterVarsity Christian Fellowship at the same time, and they've both been strong influences in my life. And I remember very well, I learned about the ASA from a little 2-inch squib in Christianity Today, but I can't remember whether it was an advertisement or a news story that's got in somehow or another, and it gave the address, which I think was Goshen, Indiana then, because the Secretary of the Treasurer was, Secretary of Treasurer on the Council was Harold Hartzler,
right.
And so I wrote to that address, or I sent a postcard, and inquired about the ASA, and I got a personal letter from this professor of physics, you know, and that made an impression on me, a personal invitation to join the ASA. I was a grad student, you know, and It was just what I was looking for, because I wanted to be encouraged in my witness in both directions, to the to colleagues who weren't Christians and to the church who didn't understand science very much. And it just fit just right. But what really clinched the deal with me was that on my way from grad school to a postdoc at Yale, or more or less a postdoc, I was able to attend my first ASA meeting. And it was the summer of 1951 at Shelton College. And my vivid memory of that meeting is watching, I watched the Columbia geochronologist Larry Culp. Well, in those days, evolution was an even hotter issue, and everybody thought they ought to weigh in on it, whether they knew anything about it or not. Yeah. And
some things never change.
I watched Larry sit there quietly in the audience through a paper on evolution by, I think it was a psychiatrist or something like that, and then right after the paper, rather than embarrass him publicly, Larry took him aside, and I heard him, you know, kind of gently but piece by piece, explain to him why just about everything he said was wrong. And I thought, these are my kind of folks, you know. That's what really clinched it with me, that I was in the right place. Yeah. And I've never been able to figure out why a lot of people in my same circumstances haven't bothered to join the ASA. Because right. Yeah. It was exactly what I was looking for.
Okay. Thank you very much. Jack. Jackson. Yeah, you're next.
The question is the first bullet.
That's the whole set.
Okay,
you know?
The whole set, all right.
Right.
So my story is much newer than Walt's, or younger maybe. I'm just a kid up here. When I was in graduate school, reading Francis Schaeffer was about all the theology that my faith demanded at that time, but it was very good for setting Christianity in a historic and cultural context. And curiously, the issue of origins and science faith per se didn't come up in my church, in several churches, until I went to Sandia Labs, where Ken Turion was already employed. And immediately he grabbed me. I don't know how Christians find each other, but maybe we stumbled into the same church. And he grabbed me and said, now we need you for several things. One of them was the local InterVarsity Area Committee, which means you raise money and love the staffer, but the other thing is ASA. You need to be in this. I didn't know what ASA was, but our church had a new pastor, and the pastor and his wife wanted to reach out to the youth. At that time was the Jesus generation, moving by hitchhiking across the country. Some of them sleeping on the lawn at the University of New Mexico, and others were students there. They wanted, their church was close, and they wanted to have a Sunday evening gathering where kids come in and have free food and talk about anything. And she invited a fellow from the congregation, whose name I still remember, to help reach out to the young people. And he was a very dogmatic, opinionated fundamentalist. And she came to me weeping the next week and said, Gene is going to destroy my ministry. Would you come and help? Well, my background in science and faith was pretty slim at that time, but the first thing, this is about the era when Genesis Flood came out, and I grabbed it and read it and thought, this is pretty good, and I actually began adopting some of the young earth positions. But then I went to my first ASA conference. It was at Stanford, I don't know what year it was, early 70s, mid 70s, and gave a paper. I don't remember what that was either. But I do know I began to encounter a much broader spectrum of views on science, faith, and the age of the earth and what have you. And I over the period of a few years, changed my position completely to something other than young earth theology. So that happened, but shortly thereafter, I was transferred in 78 to San Diego, California site, and once again, I found ASA through a local chapter, and I was amazed at the people that were there. John Wood already admitted he was there, and Walt had been there for a long time, and so was Ken Olson, and so was Dick Bube, and so were several others, Bob Miller, Jack Irvine, Chi Hang Lee, Larry Lagerstrom, a lot of people who've gone on to be on council. It was a great environment for a young scientist to learn the ropes, and these guys were all mentors, and I do appreciate that. Then, of course, Nancy began coming with me to ASA meetings, and she enjoyed this as much as I did, because we made lifelong friends. The community that was there was treasured. The worship services were always rich and full. Just one short thing more. This morning I realized all over that the depth and breadth of the discussions and the papers at ASA lifts me to a higher level than the day-to-day routine that I go back to, and begin looking down at things from a higher perspective. And it's just great from that perspective, from that standpoint.
Terrific. Thank you. Ken?
Well, I want to tell you how the ASA found me. And I'm going to mention a number of names because this is kind of a historical conference. As a chemistry student at Westmont College, I was surrounded by Roger Voskow, Cliff Benton, Stuart Ensign, Robert Frost, George Howe, George Blount, all people that participated in the ASA. And we had a fellowship there, but I went on to graduate school at Oregon State University, and who did I find there but a wealth of Christians in the science department. And that includes Virgil Freed, Dave Willis, Hendrik Orthyx, John Clausen. Give me a second here. Will Gamble, Ian Tinsley, Roy Morris, just a number of Christians surrounding the department I was in. So we had a great local section at Oregon State University, and I was a part of that, and joined shortly after I moved to Oregon State for graduate school. And then, of all things, we moved to New Jersey, and who did I move next to? An icon of the ASA, Jim Neidhart. Oh, yes. What's the chance of that happening? Mm-hmm. And through Jim, we were able to participate in a number of New Jersey, New York, local section meetings, meeting a lot up at King's College and Nyack College, and had a good fellowship there. So I pretty much was surrounded by the ASA, mm-hmm. and learned to love them, and enjoyed the local sections that we had immensely.
That's terrific, Ken, and that brings back a lot of memories, because Jim Neidhart was a big influence in my life. He's the one who led the local chapters there. I went to many of the Kings and Nyack semi-annual meetings. They were terrific. I'm trying to think. I must have met you there. There must have been some overlap.
We had
you
to. You know, Frank Roberts was there.
Yeah.
And he came up from Delaware for those meetings.
Right. When did you move away from New Jersey?
Well, I moved to New Jersey in 67 and left in 79.
79. So
67 to 70.
Probably didn't overlap too much because I arrived in 77.
Okay.
And moved away. But anyway, Jim continued for a while. I was on the executive council for that local section for a while.
And, yes. And he passed away prematurely.
Right. He did. Very much. Okay. Thank you, Ken. Back to Walt. We've got to hear a little bit more from Walt. Let's go on to the second part. Let's focus on ASA rather than on yourselves and what kind of advice or what do you see happening, what changes, anything you want.
Well,
Mike.
When I...
Mike, oops, keep me. It to your mouth.
When I joined, there were only a few hundred members. And, you know, like a grown-up organization, we had a constitution and bylaws. But in practice, we were pretty casual about this. In those days, the council members didn't rotate through the various offices like they do now. In fact, the council would get together and kind of flip a coin or pray or something like that to... figure out who could, you know, serve in the in each capacity the best, and in the 60s, I guess I ended up as the last secretary treasurer who tried to do the job and hold down a day job. And it was even worse than that because the address kept moving as we'd get a new secretary treasurer. So it moved from Goshen. When Hendrick was at Purdue, Hendrick Ortiz, he had a really crackerjack secretary, and he was very efficient as a secretary treasurer of the organization. Then he went to Oregon State, but he left the secretary, who was quite fond of the ASA, and we decided that we wouldn't move the headquarters to Ames, Iowa, where I was, and we kept her secretary and the address in West Lafayette, Indiana. And you can't imagine how complicated that was, because she would, you know, she'd get all this mail, and she would reply to everything that didn't need a decision. And the rest you'd package up and send me it once a week. And then I'd sit there and either type out final letters or rough copies for her to do or something. And I'd put them back in an envelope and mail them back to her. Well, that was, you know, you just couldn't do that. And pretty soon...
we're close to that now. It's just electronic, right?
pretty soon, we realized that was coming to an end. And by then, Harold Hartzler had moved from Goshen to Mankato State in Minnesota. And he was willing to take a part-time salary at the university and become ASA's first... paid, although half-time employee, and he was called executive secretary, I guess, and we thought he had some health problems, and in 72, we hired Bill Sisterson, who had worked for InterVarsity, and I don't know, but he was a very good manager, and then we moved the office to Elgin, Illinois, right. And we thought we'd really settle down permanently in 72, but there was this disastrous fire in 79 that burned down the building and burned up a lot of records, right. And set us back. And now, now we've got a, well, let's see, the next time it moved, well,
it moved from Elgin to Ipswich.
Yeah, moved to Massachusetts.
Yeah. In Massachusetts. And, those of you don't know, last year we finally changed the incorporation from Illinois to Massachusetts. It took us this long to get it done.
I don't know where it's incorporated. Yeah. I think it started out in...
It was California, then Illinois, and
California,
now
Illinois, and so
right.
forth. But it was, you know, it was more than a hobby with people, but it was... We were all amateurs at it until
the computer systems, you know, are supposed to reduce the workload, but seems to just open up more things to do.
No, I wrote a lot of letters on my old The typewriter I bought with my mustering outpay.
If I put in a plug here, some of you may know that the ASA archives are housed in Wheaton College in their archival stuff. And if any of you go through Wheaton at some time, it's worth going through. I mean, there's enormous amounts of material there, but the correspondence from these days are all recorded over there, and very interesting. All right, Jack?
Yesterday's session and some of the others really clarified a picture for me that I wish all new ASA members could read. It talked about revisited how ASA has evolved from the way it started to what it is now, and why we remain neutral, or at least don't take an advocacy position on things. Collectively, those four papers were really useful as a, if you want, a primer for what ASA is about, and it was so useful that I want to figure out, we need to figure out how to use it, to package it, condense it, package it, and make it available.
Where were these?
These were the, you were there. You remember how good it was? The session,
it was so good.
The session yesterday afternoon.
Oh, yesterday. Oh, I thought you were talking about several years ago. Okay, yesterday. Yes, I agree.
It was ancient history, but it was reviewed yesterday.
Right.
Okay, now we're together.
And as Terry said, that a full-blown article on that is going to be in the coming issue of the journal.
Great. I learned a few things I want to get back to them in, on the third bullet. But ASA, when I joined, seemed broader than it is now. I'm not sure that that's true. It's just a sort of personal take, because my area for many years was nuclear weapons. And hey, how does that fit? Well, it's a value-laden endeavor. And in the 1980s, the arms race was in full bore, and there were sides fighting in the streets, if you will. Certainly in Livermore they were. They were lying down and painting their silhouettes with gray paint to represent ash. And every Good Friday there was an attempt to blockade the gates, and there were arms control symposia, and ASA had one in 1988. It so happened that I had decided to take an opportunity to go work in the Pentagon on loan to the DOD to work on arms control, which was at that time a hot and heavy issue, Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty. And so the idea, which came from ASA, maybe the best idea I ever had. Our son was a senior at UC Santa Barbara and was spending his days with a bullhorn talking about the evils of the war machine. And he'd come home and we'd have not totally pleasant debates. And I decided that the best way to proceed would be, let's give a paper at Pepperdine in the fall of 88 on arms control, nuclear arms control, weapon developer and campus protester perspectives. And the good, I mean, that's the best idea God ever gave me. And the idea is that the two sides would give a perspective, and the father and son debate was equally entertaining. And what happened was that we had to spend the summer listening to each other in order to prepare that paper. And whereas we had been on opposite sides of most points for 6 or 8 years or whatever during his teenage years, that summer we became friends again. And I attribute that to ASA. In fact, Walt was behind the scenes cheering, I'm sure, because you were involved in a couple of symposia in Berkeley on that same topic. And you may not even remember, but the family of ASA actually said, go for it, and allowed that broad of an arena to speak into. So I think ASA needs to be as broad as it can be, and we have to think about how to do that while we're retaining our original mission.
I think that's great, Jack, and I like the way in which it's bottoms-up driven. You know, I mean, the leadership can say, we want to do this way, but it's not nearly as effective as the members with following their particular expertise and their issues, take the initiative and work through it. That's a great story.
And that nuclear meeting, I invited a Roman Catholic bishop to come and speak at ASA, and they didn't tell me how frightened they were about his coming. And they walked out of that meeting and he spoke for 2 hours with no notes, and they were thrilled at what they heard, and it was a total success. And then they let me know they had been scared to death to have a Roman Catholic at our meeting, so.
Great. You broke good ground there, Stan. Thank you very much. Okay, Ken?
How has the ASA changed over the years? When I joined the ASA, it was mostly Christian College Consortium of professors and students, and very few industrial researchers like myself or government workers. And fortunately, that has changed over the years. As well, the other thing is the quality of the presentations have vastly improved. There were some talks that had no slides. Paper handouts were given in the back, and the quality of the presentations were quite low. There is one memorable presentation that I remember, and it was the art of dumpster diving. And it was the most entertaining talk of all. But I'm thankful now that we have some just national speakers come and present the state of the art on different fields, and as well as the other presentations are just high quality, the same as you would expect at one of your professional society meetings. What I'd like to see the ASA do is incorporate more talks in the area of scripture, sociology, and psychology. We used to have more in those areas over the years, and they've kind of dropped by the wayside now. Another thing that's been done in the past is having a post-tour after the meeting around Scotland or the Canadian Rockies or up to Nova Scotia. Those have been very beneficial to establish fellowship and relationships among the membership of the ASA, and I'd like to encourage that to continue.
Ken, I really appreciate that, and I'd like to follow up on this a little bit, because this is near and dear to my heart, because when I started this 11 years ago, it was my very explicit goal to increase participation of industrial researchers and also secular institutions. I fear I haven't made much progress, and it is, for a number of reasons, it's much more difficult. It's harder to pinpoint potential people. It's not an audience that's easy to reach and identify. And it's more difficult for an industrial person to take a vacation and to attend. And so there's some hurdles, but I think we need to focus on it. As far as getting into these disciplines of sociology, psychology, I fully agree. I wish I knew how to do that. I've been jawboning about it. But until you have a little bit of a critical mass of people with that interest in coming and giving the talks, it's hard to do. I still recall when Mark Knoll came and gave a talk in the Boston area about 7 or 8 years ago. And he was asked, what are the key issues in the next 40 to 50 years that evangelical scholars need to grapple with? And he said two things. One is the globalization of Christianity. And the second one, he said, was evolutionary psychology. And I thought that was a key thing that we at ASA need to get in front of, you know. And I think Bill Newsom's talk kind of gets at that. You know, it's kind of the interface of the neuroscience and the psychology. So I think we're starting to do that. But I do hope we can build on that get more attention in some of these areas. And I think what we need to do, we've done it in many ways, but we need to do a better job of identifying the key seminal directions. What are the new issues? Where are they? And let's make sure that we get out in front rather than being defensive and after the cat's out of the bag and we put it all together. be some of the early issues of focus on that. So I think that's really good. Let's see. We got a few more minutes, about three more minutes for some any follow-up comments that any of you want to make before we go on.
A really weak link was we were all amateurs at publicity and public relations. And I remember when I was editing the newsletter, I made up an official sounding award for anybody who could get the ASA, those letters in print, anywhere with an oak leaf cluster, if you could get the address in too, even if it was in a footnote or so, because we were really a well-kept secret among evangelicals.
Yeah.
And I think
still are.
We probably still need to do some work on that.
Right. Except that the letters ASA now stand for about 25 different organizations, so we occasionally get dues for the wrong organization. So, okay, final comment. We've got 1 minute left.
Yesterday's talk by Terry Gray, he introduced the idea of ASA's neutrality or non-advocacy, but then it became clear that advocacy groups would spin off from ASA. We even spawned some of them. They'd spin off and form their own advocacy groups because we weren't taking an advocacy position. Therefore, almost by definition, ASA will get smaller. So that seemed like a numerical difficulty. In an unabashed advertisement, Lanny Vincent and I at 3:15 are going to be talking in which we want to provide a broader framework called innovation theology, in which we think will invite a broader audience back into the ASA fold. So if you dare.
Thank you. No, I think that's great because you're right. If you just spawn off organizations, they may leave. But I would also venture to say that the fields are white unto harvest, and there's a lot, a large group of people from which we can take, and I think we can bring them in and do that. So let's give these gentlemen a round of applause. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Third set of partners, and I think I've seen them all over here. Ken Turia, Leland Williams, Bill Ogden. Let's give you a chance here. Ken, you've got this in order of intelligence, I think.
Is that what you do?
Yeah. Oh, only question is, it reverse intelligence or the other way around? We don't know. Just kidding. Anyway, you, Ken, you're over there, and Leland, you take the Senate chair, and Phil over here. You get that. And you've got 30 seconds before the mic goes on, so if there are people who've just joined us, just... reminder of what we're doing here on the 75th anniversary. We're taking some of the people who've been members the longest here and giving them a chance to share their views. Ken, since 68, Leland since 1962, and Phil from 1970. And we're going to ask them first question or a set of questions, ask them what they were doing when they joined, how they heard about it, why, what impact. It's more of a... egocentric kind of view. Talk about yourselves. The second question, talk about ASA. Kind of give your sage advice in the word. And you get 3 minutes, each of you. Not too much. And
go.
Ken.
I was at Sandia National Laboratories. I was manager of aerophysics or aerodynamics research. I don't know where I met. I was in Chicago someplace, and I met Harold Hartzler. Harold, who Urbana Conference, I think. Yeah, 67, Urbana Conference. And he talked to me about ASA. I had never heard anything about ASA. So he told me what it is. I got very interested, and he signed me up. Mm-hmm. And since then, I have been a staunch supporter of ASA.
Yes, you have, yeah. So how did it impact you?
Well, I was looking for a professional society that was serious about their faith. Their science was good, or engineering, or their profession. But on top of that, they really had a serious concern about where they stood in their faith. So that really attracted me. I thought that's really what I was looking for. I was very into varsity. I'd been in Campus Crusade and so on, purely religious groups, but none one where science and faith was a focus.
So in what way did you interact with ASA? National meetings, the local chapters,
no,
or local the publications,
chapters.
Or what was the
national
main
meetings? That's where we started, and the journal. And if I, my first article was published in 1970, I think, mm-hmm. or 72, yeah. Mm-hmm.
So you didn't just read it, you started
yeah.
writing in it at an early age, yeah. Okay, all right. Anything else?
Oh.
Let's go on. Leland, go ahead.
Ready?
Yeah. You're on, Leland. Hold the mic close to your mouth. Yeah. So
how about that?
Up.
Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead.
It was 1962. Cornelia, I can't see you out there for the light. raise your hand and wave it.
Yeah.
Cornelia and I had been married for 10 years. I'd finished 3.5 years service in the United States Navy and finished a PhD in math at Duke University. And we found ourselves in 1962 at Florida State University, where I had gone to be an assistant professor in mathematics and assistant director of the computer center.
Louder.
Yeah, hold the
louder.
Mic closer. Yeah.
Is that better?
Yes.
I can't hear anything. Is that
Don't
better?
Worry about being too close. So just, yeah, hold
okay.
it like that. Yeah.
1962, Florida State University. One of the first contacts I made was a geologist named Bill Tanner, a member of ASA, and he encouraged me to consider joining ASA. He explained to me that it was an organization, academic and scientific and faith-based, committed to clarifying the total compatibility between science and faith. I like that idea. I like the idea of belonging to such an organization and supporting it. And so I joined. As to impact, I'll cite two examples, both coming from the 2006 Calvin College meeting. By the way, the first ASA meeting that I actually attended was at Messiah College, sometime about 1998, I think. Until then, my only impact from ASA was from reading occasional journals and newsletters. But at that Calvin College meeting, I was impacted by two people. One was a young woman named Aileen McLean, who gave a paper entitled, "Do Missionaries Wear Lab Coats?" I thought that was an enticing title, so Cornelia and I went to that session and became acquainted with Aileen and learned from her session that what she was all about was using her chemistry PhD to design and manufacture low technology diagnostic tools for use in third world countries by missionaries. And we liked that idea and fell in love with her and her ministry and have been acquainted with her and supporters of her ministry since then. So that was one big impact on me. The other impact was Francis Collins, who spoke at that same meeting. And his wonderful exposition of how faith and science had come together in his life, as well as what he learned from sequencing the human genome, impacted my life in terms of using ideas from his lecture that night to help me clarify the compatibility of science and faith for people I came in contact with.
Mm. That's great. Thank you. May I just comment at that 2006 meeting, program chair was Bud Bauma, who was mentioned previously, and that's the meeting at which Francis Collins launched his book, The Language of...
The meeting at which what?
At Calvin, the one you talked about.
Who launched a book?
He launched.
Launched.
Francis Collins launched his book.
Yes. I got a signed copy right there.
And I think many of us were affected by Lynn's paper there that month. Okay, great. Thank you very much. Phil?
I joined ASA in 1970 while I was on the faculty teaching physics and a little bit of astronomy at Roberts Wesleyan College in Rochester, New York. And I'm not sure why I did not join before that, because clear back in 1951, my father, who was a pastor, and he bought this book, Modern Science and Christian Faith, published by ASA, and he wrote the date, 7 July 1951, inside. But at some point, he gave it to me. At that time, I was between junior high and high school. But and also, I had contact with a number of scientists who are Christians, including my research advisor at Cal Berkeley, and I taught for 5 years at Seattle Pacific University and worked with faculty colleagues there. But it wasn't until a year that I went to Roberts Wesleyan College, I came in contact with some other members of ASA, and they encouraged me to join, and I have been happy to be involved in it ever since. The impact of ASA on me has been very significant, I believe. The journals and the annual meetings have really helped to strengthen my faith dramatically. And my commitment to coordinating together of science and faith have really been solidified through ASA. The annual meetings have been real highlights to me. I especially enjoyed the meetings at Cambridge and at Edinburgh.
Oh, yeah.
The only negative memory I have from annual meetings has nothing to do with the meetings, but after the Catholic University of America meeting, a few days later, I got a letter in the mail from the Washington Police with a picture of our car and a speeding ticket.
Trying to get away as fast as you could.
Nothing to do with the meeting. My membership in ASA has helped me a lot in my teaching. Another ASA member, David Barnes, and I developed and team-taught a course at Roberts Wesleyan College for more than 30 years entitled Technology in Modern Society. And a big unit in that course was on a Christian worldview and a Christian view of science. And that course was required of all students, so it impacted thousands of students. So ASA had a big role in my teaching career. Contacts at ASA also were helpful for me in bringing speakers to Roberts Wesleyan College for special events. George Murphy and a number of others in that category.
Okay, thank you very much. All right, let's take the next round of questions. Let's focus on ASA a little bit. Talk a little bit about what ASA was like, how it's changed, and where do you think it should go based on your experience?
Those are the $64 questions, right?
Right.
Yeah. Well, the change was very clear because when I joined, it was mostly an old men's club.
I like your use of the past tense.
Yeah. And that has changed to my delight. And so many women have joined, and even the CEO is now a woman. This is great. That's one. My avocation is apologetics. So I started with young earth creationism in Lebanon. That's all there was. Slowly I realized I wasn't going to answer the question, so I slowly moved from there. And joining ASA really opened the doors wide, that there are other alternatives. Dropped that and moved on. So that's one impact. In fact, several things. In fact, I learned from Sisterson. Wasn't Sisterson was the person who was like not a CEO, but he did initially was...
He was the executive director from 1972 to 81.
He gave me that picture of God and the two, you know, which you are also using, the two directions you go, scientific interpretation,
right.
And so on.
Yeah.
I have worked on that. I've translated it into several languages that I speak and I teach at. So I have used that and keep using it. It's on my permanent, on my slide, series of slides. My hero was, of course, Bube, because he came to Sandia, and some of the backgrounds we share. And he and I are a team. He's like this, and I'm like this. The two of us really made a team. The thing I want to know, and I don't, is how many of our members are non-Protestant, in other words, Catholic or Orthodox? Do we know that? I surely would like to see more of that group come in if we have not worked closely with them.
I don't know the exact numbers. They keep changing. We have a survey that's online that kind of says where we were in 2008 or 2009. I think we took the survey. So the percentages are not zero. I'd like to see them high. I think that conference at Washington, D.C. was at the Catholic University of America.
That's right.
That helped open up some things. And so there's been a little progress. Again, I think, though I'm glad about progress, I still think we have a long way to go on diversity on all fronts, not, you know, gender, ethnicity, and denominations. We've got some work to do here, and I think visibility across the board.
My background is Armenian Apostolic Church, the Eastern Orthodox Church, but I grew up more in the Protestant tradition. But most of my friends, my colleagues especially, are apostolics, and so that's what I try to bring more of them to the ESA.
Right.
And see more join.
Okay. Excellent. Lena, your thoughts?
Okay. Because of my limited involvement in ASA in the years 1962 and subsequent 8 or 10 years, I'll have to answer the first two questions in terms of changing my connection with ASA. Since those years, and since Calvin College in particular, we have attended and participated in many more ASA meetings, and been enriched by both the fellowship and the presentations by fellow ASA members at those meetings. As to change for ASA's future, I'm remembering some contact that I had in the early to mid 80s, when I was at Triangle University's Computation Center in North Carolina. Bill Sisterson came by working with attempts to create local chapters in that area, and Bob Herman came by, and I learned from these two, probably mostly from Bob Herman, about the project that he was working with Owen Gingrich to create a TV documentary for public presentation of the area between science and faith, for the clarifying the unification of those two concepts for the public, producing a documentary similar to Carl Sagan's Cosmos, which had just come out, from a totally non-Christian perspective. And I understand that that project didn't get off the ground because funding was never found for it. But maybe there are other funding sources now, and I'd love to see ASA manage to produce that kind of witness to the general public.
Yeah, if I just may interject here, I don't know how many of you are aware of that piece of history, that Bob Herman and Owen Gingrich had made a lot of progress in this follow-on TV series to Carl Sagan's Cosmos back at that time, with some encouragement from John Templeton. And so I asked Bob Herman a few years ago in terms of, tell me really, why didn't that ever happen? Because we've got all these folders of documents from everything and nothing's happened with it. And he says, really what happened is they needed, I think it was about $3 million or so to pull it off. It was a pretty large, maybe it was less than that, but it was a fairly large amount. And in the end, Sir John Templeton said, You know, I really don't think that television is the right medium to reach the thought leaders of the of our society. That's not the right medium. I don't want to pay for television. Okay. Bob wasn't able to dissuade him of it, so it's another case of Templeton not funding a key project. It was tough. But they funded a lot of other things instead, I guess. So. Okay, Bill.
When I joined ISA, the membership was quite a bit smaller. I was a little surprised. Some have been talking about the membership decreasing in recent years. Is that correct?
That's right.
There has been growth in between in the last 46 years, certainly. But I also have sensed some change. Although I was happy to hear today that there's renewed interest in regional local sections. I was involved in the formation of the Western New York section and was an officer in that for 4 years. But I probably wasn't very good at keeping it alive because it died while I was still there. But it was a good experience, and I would like to see in the future more development of local sections. I think that's a really valuable tool in reaching people who cannot necessarily get to a lot of our annual meetings. There have been many changes, many positive developments I see in the organization over the years. A greater interest in pulling in more students and young scientists. I think that's a very good thing, and I'd like to see that grow. Greater interest in developing diversity, ethnic, and in other ways. And so I think the directions are there, and I think there's a lot of work being done to make some of those changes, and I'd like to see those kind of changes come into greater fruition.
Yeah, I should just clarify on the membership. That total membership has actually been growing a little bit, but if you look under the covers, the paying membership has dropped. You know, so it depends on how you slice it. Student membership has been going up significantly. Well, we're giving them free memberships, which is important. Okay, and seriously, we started that 4 years ago, and you know, our student membership jumped from about, I think it was 150 at the time, and now we have over 1,000. Okay. On the other hand, you know, that's the effectiveness of the faculty members saying, join.
Are some of the students becoming paying members?
Well, now's the time, you know, some of them are, but we're just beginning that transition because we have been deliberately very liberal. The idea was, you kind of catch them at the maybe undergraduate, junior, senior level, and it's easiest to get the Christian colleges. We really want to penetrate the secular colleges. Then the idea is that the ones you really want to retain are the ones going on to graduate school. So there's a filter there. And well, that's going to take them a while through graduate school, so we kind of gave them a 4-year free membership. And after 4 years, well, they're still in grad school. Hey, all right, you can have another 4 years here. And so we haven't really had the chance to see this first crop, you know, come through and see how go. And the key thing is to provide a value to them at this stage in terms of, at the end of that term, is it valuable enough for me to put down some money and time in doing that? So we shall see. There's a lot of work to be done here, but that's kind of a little bit more clarity in terms of where it is. Let's see, how much time? Oh, we got a few minutes here for follow-on. Is there, first of all, before we get questions, is there any additional comment you want to
throw in? Well, one follow-on is that from 1999 till 2007, I was on a Department of Energy delegation team to visit all the institutes of the former Soviet Union. Weapons institutes. That's where I got acquainted with a number of Russian, Belarusian, and other colleagues, and talked about ASA and created interest. And so we made a proposal when I was a council member to the Temple Foundation for $1 million to start chapters. Unfortunately, it was turned down, and the mistake was mine. It was poorly written. I made some stupid statements, which I didn't go over carefully. And we got negative reviews, and it died. That's one. The success for me was, when did you join? 2003, right? When did you actually become CEO, not join?
2005. 2005. Beginning of 2005.
When was the Vancouver meeting? Was it 2004 or 5?
2004.
Okay, that's when I was chairman of the council, and
yes,
we looked and looked, and boy, we wanted this dude, all right? And then it became evident, a vice president from IBM, boy, you are a dreamer. And so I had an appointment with him to sit down and have coffee. We decided upon him. And then I said, you know, will you be willing to, knowing that he will say no? He said, I believe I will. I was dumbfounded. I couldn't talk. And that has been, to me, one of the biggest successes of ASA, is trying to get you as a CEO.
Oh, you're very kind. Yes, I remember that meeting. It was a hot one, but we had a lot of good discussions at that time. It was indeed there where we kind of made the decision to come in. And then Don, let's see, that was in July. And Don moved from Massachusetts, yep, North Carolina in December, and I started in February 1. Right? So it was good memories over there.
It was an event.
Right. Leave it.
I can't top that story, and I'm not going to try. I'll pass.
I pass also.
Anything else? Okay, about 5 minutes. Any more questions or anything from, let's see if I can see any. Any questions for these gentlemen?
How are we doing in terms of sexual diversity and ethnic diversity? Have we gotten any better in the last 15 years?
Gender diversity is definitely improving, far from where it should be, and I hope that will continue to change. In terms of ethnic diversity, part of the problem is it's hard to get statistics, because it's not one of those questions we're asking in our application, and it's a little bit tricky as to whether you do or not. And so if you notice, well, new members may remember, but if you look at your application, we do not ask for age, and we do not ask for ethnicity on the application, nor for a photo. And I think generally for good reasons, even though we'd love to have that. So we kind of have to infer it indirectly from, the year you graduated or something like that when you got your degree. Well, I don't have good data on the ethnic diversity, but I do know without a doubt that it's not good enough. It's not where we should be. I guess the reference points should be the degree of diversity in the scientific community. I'm not sure that's the right measure either. Don't know what the right measures are, but there's no doubt, because many people have mentioned today already that diversity is an important component, and we need to feature it, and we need to be intentional about it, and to make sure we get it, so we have a lot more to do. It's another hand there. Terry?
Would you and any of the others comment on recruiting from sector universities, particularly graduate students, faculty, et cetera, from sector as contrasted with the Christian College?
I'd love to get some ideas on that. You know, any one have a some golden bullets here, or things that we can use? How do we attract the faculty or students from secular institutions?
I would say one contact would have to be Christian faculty members who are there.
And how do we find them?
Well, that's a good question.
Yeah, okay.
Do we have a database that would tell us who they are?
No.
In the organization now?
We can get database on Christian colleges. The secular institutions, no. I don't have it. I don't know where to find it.
Really?
Yes.
Isn't that a way we could work with InterVarsity?
Exactly the point, which is why we've significantly strengthened our connection with InterVarsity. Tom Grosch is here, the Emerging Scholar Network. And one of the strategic motivations here is not just the students per se, but the faculty, Christian faculty networks that InterVarsity has at all of these schools. So we're hoping this is going to pay off in that direction.
Because I do a number of talks on apologetics, both Christian and secular universities, CSM, CSU, CCU, I invariably, a lot of non-Christians attend, and Christians attend, and I use ASA as a launching pad for further involvement. Here is an opportunity for you, and I have done that. A number of them have joined as a result.
Yeah. I think the other area that I'm keen on and don't know how to penetrate is industrial research, or government research, industrial research. Don't have an university that will penetrate that very well. And, you know, I was at IBM my whole career, but my connection with ASA came through Wheaton College. So it was really back through the Christian College route. So, yes, the Christian College route remains the dominant pathway, and we have to keep finding ways to get other pathways as well, because there are a lot of people who don't come through that door. And when I found that IBM, we had a fairly active Bible study group and so on. But in my experience in the industrial world, the Christians that were there didn't have a background from a Christian college. They had no awareness that you even needed to integrate science and faith. It was very well compartmentalized. You know, this is what you do at work, and this is what you do at church. All of this, you have to think about bringing it together. And so I found it hard, really, to really get a lot of my Christian colleagues at IBM to be interested in it. So they didn't even know the words was an issue in many cases. They didn't grow up with that. Keith.
Yeah, just to follow up on that, I mean, Ruth and I spent our whole careers in secular institutions, and that's precisely what we encounter, is that there's a very large Christian faculty presence at K-State, for example, but most of them, again, are compartmentalized. They see their Christian faith being played out in their churches, you know, their elders or deacons, municipal leaders, but there's no... They don't perceive a need for integration. And I think
right.
That seems to be the big hurdle,
yeah.
Is that of faculty seeing they're having their lives compartmentalized.
Right, yeah. And I don't know how to stimulate that. If you don't have it inherently, or if you haven't learned that in some of your classes, how do we generate that?
So. If you have time, another input on that from the industry perspective. They're not paid to publish. They're not paid to travel to ASA meetings. They get no tenure credit for it. What then would lure them here? If they were welcomed in and felt a place here, they might come more frequently. But in fact, if we focus on research and science as our objective, the industrial engineers and applied scientists don't see a place for themselves. We need to broaden our definition of science to include the very applied sciences and engineering.
Hear, hear. I would strongly echo that. And if you didn't hear that, Jack Swearingen was pointing out that to attract a lot of these people, we need to focus a little bit more on engineering, applied technology kind of tracks. And I'm very pleased, you know, Walter Bradley and others have really initiated and taken a lot of steps to it. I would really like to see that grow more actionable rather than just sitting and thinking, and I think that attracts a lot of people. And is an important part of growth in terms of our effectiveness and being attractive. And I think next year's theme, I don't know if you're going to announce it tonight or something, but it's going to be, you know, much more on sustainability and energy issues, and it's going to be more in that direction. But there's a lot more that we can do. So with that, I think our time is up, and let's give a round of applause to these three gentlemen. Thank you very much. And thank you all. It's now a coffee break.